You're listening to The Read Out. One development leader, their big idea, and how it can shape the future of Australian development assistance. Hosted by Lab CEO, Bridie Rice.
I don't know about you, but in our lab offices, you can't go very far without finding a fluoro yellow copy of Schwartz Media's A Foreign Affairs, generally sitting a little bit dog-leafed on a table. And whilst the AFA isn't best known for its coverage of development, we have noticed an uptick of content on Australia's near region. Their latest edition out last month was no exception to the rule. Now, when it comes to the Pacific Islands, the Australian international relations community's attention is so often captured by the latest security or economic agreement struck by China's PRC, or indeed, most recently, Australia's own Falapelli Union deal with Tuvalu. But beneath all this deal-making is some policy momentum to connect Australia to countries in the region. Yes, perhaps it's driven by the odd game of whack-a-mole with adversaries, but beyond that, there is a growing and more sophisticated recognition that Australian development can help connect our people, our economies, our systems of knowledge with countries in the Pacific, and that this delivers social and economic benefits for everyone in our region, Australia included. Now, if this is sounding familiar, well, the idea is certainly not new. The US has had compact states in the Pacific Islands for a long time. Of course, the European Union itself is a grand experiment of regional development, and Australia is making moves on increasing labour mobility and travel within the Pacific. So my guest today, Hervé Lemayeux, is the latest analyst putting up the case for what he's calling a Pacific EU, and it appeared in what I think is the best section of the Australian Foreign Affairs. It's called The Fix. Now, his particular policy pitch is called How Can Australia Unleash Its Own Brussels Effect in the Pacific Island Region? And I'm thrilled to have Hervé here with me to unpack his ideas. Hi, Hervé.
Thanks so much for having me.
Well, look, I have been following your work at the Lowy Institute for a while now, and you're not short of bold policy proposals, but I have to admit I was not expecting this one from you. So can you talk our listeners through the central idea and why does it have legs?
Yeah, well, I guess I wasn't expecting it from myself either, if you'd asked me 18 months ago, but it was really listening to some of the big speeches that have been made in Australia by Pacific leaders, by people like Deputy Prime Minister Biman Prasad of Fiji, who's called for a visa-free Pacific, or by Prime Minister Fiame of Samoa, who also called for a European Union-style common market. And it sort of set off a light bulb in me. The inner sort of European integrationist got very excited. And I thought, well, it's a strange parallel to be striking. But the more I think about it, the more there are analogies, you know, direct points of comparison. And perhaps there is some of that logic of European integration that could be applied to our very own region in the Pacific. So yes, I think there's never been a better time for this. I think, you know, necessity is the mother of all invention, and it's clear that we've tried and tested many things in the Pacific. There are real limitations, there are real crises, whether that's climate change, stagnant development, in fact, the corrosive influence of geopolitics on weak governance. Any number of those issues can be tackled through an integrationist lens.
So, Hervé, let's go a little bit deeper into your proposal. And of course, it is inspired at least a little by the University of Columbia's Anu Bradford's idea of a Brussels effect. Now, your basic argument goes that by enmeshing Pacific Island countries, Australia and New Zealand, into an EU-style project, the region as a whole will be better equipped to advance its collective interests, just like, for example, the EU does. But you're also fairly clear-headed that this idea is not new, and there have been plenty of false starts in the past, including in the Pacific. So where are you seeing the potential here?
Well, look, when we talk about integration, there are a million and one variants, right? And it's been tried and tested in the Pacific, both in the kind of security domain, you know, plus ça change, plus c'est la même chose, you know, things, they come and go. If you go back to the Cold War, there were attempts by Australia and New Zealand to create a security community, and that was seen as highly patronizing and sort of in one direction only, and it was to do with trying to stop mainland China from established diplomatic relations in the Pacific, which was seen as hypocritical because both Australia and New Zealand had, of course, established diplomatic relations with the PRC. There were attempts at sectoral integration, and that sort of failed. And well, I mean, failure is a strong word, but I think the biggest impediment here is that trade integration doesn't really work very well among a set of Pacific Island states that are geographically fragmented and don't have complementary economies. So in many cases, we end up sort of competing with each other rather than finding synergies. And I think the other problem is that, again, a collection of island states. I grew up in part in the Caribbean, and I know there was an experiment for the West Indies Federation at one point. And that sort of collapsed because they couldn't agree on where the capital should be based. You know, contentious arguments about where the Pacific airline or the cruise liner or whatever it is should be based. So we've been there before, but I do think there is potential in at least three ways. One is that, as you say, there's the kind of Brussels effect, which is that the regulatory clout of Europe is enormous and works in indirect ways. It's the magic sauce in Europe's ability to influence global commerce. And that's because of its market size, 470 million people, and also because it has some of the most stringent regulations in the world. And a lot of multinationals end up incorporating EU rules and regulations into their global operations. So that's the Brussels effect. And look, Australia is nowhere near the size of the EU, but relative to the Pacific, Australia has regulatory clout. But we don't have, for example, a united telecommunications sector. If we did, no doubt our standards would travel in the rest of the Pacific. The second is that the EU has something called the enlargement policy, right? And the sort of stereotype of Europe, especially in the Anglophone world and in Australia, is that, you know, the Europeans are completely geopolitically illiterate, right? These are people who have woken up to the war in Ukraine and suddenly realize that they've got to up their defense spending. But I would argue that the best defense that Europe has geopolitically has been the success of Europe and Europe's expansion. And that has kind of eaten into Russia's traditional sphere of influence in Eastern Europe. It's the reason why young Ukrainians wake up feeling more energized by the prospect of joining the European Union than by the prospect of rejoining a post-Soviet sphere of influence. So a sphere of integration works differently to a sphere of influence. And I think there is something to the idea of binding societies together from the bottom up rather than from the top down that could be really powerful in the Pacific. And the third way it works is that in many ways, Europe was a deeply geopolitical project at its outset in 1951 with the creation of the European Coal and Steel Community. But it was explicitly aimed at trying to sap out all the power politics between its member states, because, of course, we're dealing with enormous asymmetries. I'm originally from Belgium. We're a tiny country. We've been pummeled by larger neighbors for centuries. How does a country like Germany or even France overcome the historical luggage that they have with smaller neighbors? And that's, you know, very different. But in Australia, we also have, we have to be honest, historical luggage in the Pacific. There is a lot of suspicion around our agenda in the Pacific and a lot of suspicion that geopolitics rules the day. So how do we come up with a project that is both effective geopolitically in terms of our competition with China, but is also offering the region something that is post-geopolitical, you know, and that offers a level playing field among its member states? And again, I think the EU offers a way forward.
Well, Hervé, let me push you on this, if you will, because I hear a lot in this town about these win-win situations, what's great for the region and great for Australia at the same time. So I want to go another round on it. And in particular, I've noticed that you're not the only one talking about the need for a more integrated Pacific. Now, Professor Stephen House from ANU jumped on this podcast arguing for how a visa-free Pacific would deliver economic benefits to the region at a fairly marginal cost. And of course, a couple of years ago, we had the UK's Jonathan Glenny arguing here in Canberra that the idea of actually pooling resources within the EU for redistribution could be applied to foreign aid in the Pacific. But there, the idea would be each country contributing and working together towards common goals rather than, say, merely dispersing or receiving assistance in an aid paradigm. But the thing is that both of these thinkers were pushing a regional collective benefit, and particularly a development benefit, as the primary goal of this work. And indeed, Australia's new development policy does just that. It puts connecting the region to Australia for development as one of its primary focuses. But as you've said, the Australian security community writ large and your article frame this idea of integration with the Pacific in much more stark terms. You are saying it's an answer for what you are calling a missing strategy to break the wicked problem of playing whack-a-mole with China across the region. So I guess my question really is it all very well for us sitting here in Canberra, leafing through our copy of AFA in the comfort of our home to swallow this hollis bollis? I mean, the idea of an Australian-dominated Pacific, where the biggest economy calls all the shots, is not exactly what I'm hearing Pacific leaders are desperate to sign up for. It certainly caused problems in Europe. So what are the risks to manage here and the gaffes that, frankly, Australia has to overcome if we're going to make these connections or this project, as you say, full of integrity?
Yeah, no, I think you're onto something very big here. I think there are, and this is my observations as a relative outsider to this debate, you know, there are warring tribes basically within Australia's policy community. There's this sort of security establishment that views everything in very stark binary terms in the competition with China. And of course, then there's the development crowd who actually see geopolitics as a distraction to the main game, which is really lifting the prosperity and welfare of Pacific Island states. And I suppose where I would position myself is to say that integration is the third way. Integration is a potential bridge that gets us both the development outcomes we need, that looks after and seeks to remedy the power asymmetries in the region and the post-colonial anxiety that Pacific Island states often air. And at the same time, indirectly, would result in the region as a whole being better inoculated against the worst excesses of geopolitics. And I'm deliberately not arguing for a security community. And by the way, that's not how the European Union works either. You know, a common defense and foreign policy for the EU is still elusive, right? But I would argue you don't need one when you combine 27 countries together economically, when through a common travel area, you give rise to a kind of European identity, which is what we need for the Pacific. And in time, what happens, and this has to be a multi-generational effort, is that you bind societies in ways that they see their interests as being in lockstep with one another. But you don't approach that through the jugular. And this is also, I think, in some sense, a reply to an article by John Blaxland that also appeared in the Australian Foreign Affairs Journal, which was to sort of say, let's offer compact associations with Pacific Island states. And I think for a variety of reasons, it's never going to work, or it may work for individual countries, but it's not going to work for the region as a whole. Sovereignty is a prized possession, as it is in Europe as well, by the way, for smaller member states, and certainly on foreign and security policy. So there's got to be another way. And by the way, even if you go with the compact state approach and it works for one or two countries, I think it could be divisive regionally. It could actually result in greater divisions within the Pacific Island forums between those who are in and those who are out. So you've got to come up with a sort of multilateral framework, but one that is still flexible enough that it has what we call a multi-speed Europe, a multi-speed Pacific integration project. And that's why I'm sort of calling for a big idea, which is to commit to and then progressively ease barriers on the free movement of data, capital, and people, the three freedoms, and that's across the blue Pacific continent. But I'm then specifically saying the way you approach that big idea is through taking small concrete steps. And that is exactly how European integration unfolded. You know, you went from the coal and steel community to a European Union of 470 million people with a parliament. But that starts, I think, in the Pacific with the creation of a digital single market. And that's really to do with data and capital. The fact is, we've already de facto and almost by accident, as Australia, gotten involved in this space through Telstra's takeover of Digicel Pacific. And we're building cables, but it's not just the hard infrastructure that matters here, it's the soft infrastructure. And much as coal and steel in Europe in the 1950s was sort of a vector of geopolitical competition, but also a solution for it, I argue that telecommunications and technology in the Pacific today offers us the same kind of opportunity. So I'm saying, let's get rid of roaming charges. That'll be beneficial to the Pacific. It'll be beneficial for Australian and Kiwi tourists in the Pacific as well, reinforcing the sense of a single Pacific family. But let's more importantly also think about a remittances app. You know, if you were to drop some of the price of the transaction costs on remittances, that would automatically inject cash, you know, and not government funding, but hard-earned cash into the national economies of Pacific Island states that come to depend on that sort of thing. And again, I'm borrowing from ideas of visa-free travel. It's been around for a long time. I've got a great colleague called Jess Collins in the Pacific team who has written the remittances paper. And so you can actually, I think, both under the idea of a digital single market, merging of telecommunications sectors, and then the phased expansion of the Trans-Tasman travel arrangement, which is something that already holds between Australia and New Zealand, is already a prototype, basically Schengen area equivalent for the Pacific, and already encompasses 25% of the Pacific Island Forum membership through New Zealand's association with a variety of different Pacific Island states. Why not a phased expansion of that common travel area and do it in a phased way? So you go through accession talks, you come up with basically entry criteria, you look at institutional stability, economic compatibility, good governance. I would think a country like Fiji would probably be first up the rank for consideration. But you also make that conditional on accession states coming into the Trans-Tasman travel area in exchange for opening their own climate mobility pathways for the most climate vulnerable countries in the Pacific. So you're doing two things. It's an expression of solidarity, both with regard to the best governed countries in the Pacific, but also for those countries to take a greater share in more burden sharing in extending help to the most climate vulnerable Pacific Island states. And so I think in that way, you're building the building blocks, as it were, for something that is far more ambitious, but that will play out over many decades.
Wow, it sounds as though we need to not just have one episode on this topic, Ave, but I now feel as though there's a good three in the pipeline. But look, we are drawing to a close, and I feel as though you've gotten ahead of the game, but I'm going to give you a chance anyway. So here is your standing lab hypothetical to finish off the episode today. So, Ave, imagine you are going about your normal day at work, and as you press the button to call the elevator and the doors open, you discover none other than the Foreign Minister and the Minister for International Development have stopped by for a visit. Now, it turns out that they've read your fix, and Penny Wong turns to you. She peers down over her glasses and she says, "Go on, what would you do if you were me? You've got a minute. Are you ready? Off you go."
I would say, first of all, if Europe and the European experience is any guide, attempts at political and security assimilation are not going to work in the Pacific. You've got to go, certainly not if premised on the strategic denial of China's influence. That sort of language, and I think Penny Wong would agree, doesn't work in the Pacific. Rather than vertical or top-down patronizing type integration, what you need is horizontal integration by removing barriers on the movement of data, capital, and people. That's how you tackle that problem, firstly. Secondly, you have to be bold in terms of how you communicate that, not only in the Pacific, but at home. I think that's going to require really bold political ambition and vision. And you've got to forcefully convey to voters here the strategic urgency and the economic opportunity of bringing the Pacific family together in unprecedented ways. If you look at Brexit, for example, that is how not to do it, right? Which is that projects of this nature very rarely end well without the social license at home to propel them forward. And my last point of advice is begin piecemeal. Of course, we look at the EU today and say, it'll never work in the Pacific. It's a European solution to a European problem. Fair enough. I'm not calling for a Pacific EU, actually. I'm calling to borrow for some of the logic of European integration. I think there's a big distinction there. The political evolution of a project like this necessarily hinges on all the member states of the PIF. There may never be an equivalent of the European Commission for a decentralized organization of Pacific Island states. It may be that we go with intergovernmental treaties rather than a European Parliament. We don't know, but you have to start piecemeal and build the building blocks. And like Germany, lead from behind. So it's not about dictating the agenda, but it's about creating the enabling environment, the conditions, the prerequisites for integration to start taking hold.
Well, Hervé, it has been absolutely fantastic to have you on the readout today.
Thank you so much.
Join me next time on The Readout, where each episode we sit down with one author, one big idea, and talk about how it can shape the future of Australia's development assistance. And if you liked hearing from Hervé on an integrated Pacific, then you can find a link to his article in our show notes. But if you want extra previews, insights, and development analysis, then you can sign up to our email at devintelligencelab.com. A special thanks to the lab team behind the scenes, Ruby Solwick and Walter Kolnagy. Our music is by Viljami Meto. I'm Bridie Rice. This is The Readout. Talk soon.
We at The Lab acknowledge the traditional owners of the lands on which this podcast is recorded, the Ngunnawal and Ngambri people, and we extend our respects to their elders past, present and emerging. We're inspired by the storytelling tradition of the world's oldest living culture, and we pay homage to it when we share our stories or intelligence on this podcast.